Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Tough on podcasts, tough on the causes of podcasts. Strike up the bands!
If in doubt, say nout, but not for long.
The other thing that Polly left out was otters.
And nobody is giving votes to ghosts.
Ghost dogs.
Yes, here we are again. It's How to Win an Election with me, Matt Shawley, joined by Daniel Finkelstein, Polly McKenzie, and Peter Mandelson. If you want to get in touch, you can email us howtowin@thetimes.co.uk, howtowin@thetimes.co.uk, attach a voice note. Or if you want to WhatsApp us, make sure you put How to Win in the message so we can find it. 0333 003 2353. That's 0333 003 2353. We'll put all the details in the description so we can find all of that. Right, how are we all?
Yeah, I think I may have been wrong about votes for otters because they may need them to run in Rochdale.
So we should explain. I say we, Polly has gone viral. So this is what happened on the podcast last week. Before we get into votes for otters and ghost dogs, this is Polly making what she thought was a perfectly reasonable suggestion.
I'm just going to say something that you probably will all think I'm joking, but I'm deadly serious, which is that I think people should get votes from birth. I think there is no good reason to disenfranchise the under-18s at all. And I would be happy for parents to hold that vote in proxy until their child is, say, 10.
So that was your initial suggestion. We then talked about people who weren't yet born, people who were dead, animals, and then obviously ghost dogs. It's been seen now more than 350,000 times on what we used to call Twitter. Is this the first time you've gone viral, Polly?
No, I've done worse things. Don't know.
Wait. Such as?
Oh, well, there's a thing about plastic bags. But actually,
What is the thing about plastic bags? Why do... Because people keep bringing up, they blame you personally if I have to pay for a plastic bag. Like, that's a bad thing.
Oh, no, they blame me for, I don't know, murdering benefit claimants or something. It's quite complicated. Just to be clear, because I was once in an election campaign accused of having stolen a council house.
Wow.
And I have not stolen a council house. I have not murdered anybody, right, just in case there's any doubt. Right, so here's the thing about being trolled on the internet that I have had a few times. It is when a woman says something that people disagree with, is what you usually get is not, oh, I disagree with that, which is totally fine. I made what I admit is a radical and unusual suggestion. People are very welcome to disagree with me. But what's interesting about the comments is it's all, this is what's wrong with white Western women, or this is why women shouldn't have the vote. And women are so often in public life, you know, held up to a different sort of standard, where if Matt Chorley's wrong, it's because Matt Chorley's an idiot. But if Polly McKenzie's wrong...
It's got a big fat face quite often, yeah, or ears.
It's called misogyny.
I know, it's called misogyny, and it really, really...
I think that's called mansplaining, Peter. But you're right. So I obviously retweeted all the videos of How to Win. But if I ever retweet like a female journalist or columnist, and then people, you know, I then see people replying to it, it's extraordinary the difference. So if I tweet that Danny's done a great column, people might be he's wrong for this or the other reason. But the instant misogyny to a woman saying something that someone disagrees with is mad.
Yeah, and it's that you have let down the entire half of the species by just having a wrong opinion. And that's just well, it's profoundly wrong, but it also it works to kind of drive women out of public life in a way that I think is genuinely harmful.
Yeah, you know, so the interesting thing is, as you know, I didn't agree with your idea about babies voting, but actually almost every baby would exercise the discretion in the franchise better than the people who responded under your article. I mean, it really did rather prove your point. I once went viral because I wrote an article about Winston Churchill, in which I said that he was a great man, but he was undeniably racist. I think that is basically, you know, the only possible defensible position. This appeared in the Times as Winston Churchill was racist, but he was a great man, as opposed to Winston Churchill was a great man, but he was racist. And this was then retweeted something like 17 million times, a lot, in other words, as a photoshopped headline.
I'm feeling really left out. How can I go viral?
I'm sure you have, Peter.
Dancing? Could we get you dancing?
Oh, jumpers.
Work?
Yeah. Definitely. More jumpers.
Yeah, more jumpers. Wearing all of your jumpers. Well, Polly, somebody actually tried to take your suggestion seriously. Alex got in touch and emailed howtowinatthetimes.co.uk. He said, while I agree with lowering the age to vote to 16, I disagree with giving this right to younger children, especially allowing parents to vote on the behalf of their children. This would mean the larger the family is, the more votes they would get. This would jeopardise the rights of those people with fewer or no children and potentially result in disproportionate representation.
Well, that's an entirely reasonable argument. I do disagree. Because I think that is a feature, not a bug, in what I propose. Nobody is a perfect representative of, you know, like, the future. But I think that would help to increase the chances of the needs of future generations being reflected in the decisions that we make as a society. That's all. It's imperfect. Everything's imperfect.
Well, by the way, Alex, making an interesting point without being a sexist pig. We've had another email in because obviously since we gathered last week, there's quite a lot has happened in politics, not least the Labour Party discovering that they don't necessarily know who's standing for them. So we had an email from Pat, said, "Hi, loving the podcast and the theme tune, of course," which might be sarcasm, Pat, but I'm going to ignore that. Pat goes on, "Selecting candidates can be problematic. How could parties improve the process to protect themselves from having the wrong candidates?" Peter?
I think in the main the Labour Party does do that. I mean, the exception proves the rule. The rule is, and I've met dozens of newly selected Labour candidates, and I'm really impressed by them. I mean, candidate for candidate, they're sort of, in the main, better than the ones, frankly, we selected in the 1990s before when New Labour was being created. So I'm very happy with the way in which candidates are selected in the Labour Party, but sometimes something goes wrong.
Yeah,
went wrong in Rochdale. I don't quite understand really what happened in Rochdale, because Azhar Ali, the Labour candidate who has now been sort of stood down as Labour, has a long history of being a friend of Israel, a Jewish ally, somebody who has campaigned with Jewish organisations. And actually, a lot of the representatives of these organisations spoke up for him that weekend. And yet, something ghastly is going on in the country where somebody like him feels to go into a private meeting in Rochdale of people who are concerned about Gaza, feels he has to say these things and pander to this sort of sentiment in a way that he did, and as a result he was rightly stood down as a candidate. But what is it about this sort of poisonous, fetid atmosphere that is enveloping the country over this issue that people like him feel the need to say those, frankly, racist things?
Yeah, I first of all, can I stick up for Sir Karl Popper and say that the exception doesn't prove the rule? Obviously, that's the whole point of exceptions and rules. But
who's Karl Popper?
He's a philosopher who you studied at university.
Well, I didn't go to university, Peter.
I'll get you a copy.
I did do philosophy A-level, but I might not have been paying attention.
So there's a chance for a late entry.
Brian McGee's small book on Karl Popper is fantastic, and actually, knowing you well as I do, I think you'll get a lot out of it. It's very good. But
I like that term.
But obviously, the problem, Peter points to the correct problem, which is you can take whatever robust measures you like, and you'll still end up with some candidate. I was involved in a candidate selection of a candidate in Watford, near where I live. I was asked to do the kind of interviews. And at the end of this interview, I came to the conclusion that the candidate they'd selected, while solid, was very boring. And I felt this was, you know, it was a shame they chose the boring candidate, but at least he was safe, whereas the others I thought maybe were more of a punt. Anyway, about 6 months after he'd been selected, news stories began to appear in the paper. The editor of the local newspaper had a pot of paint thrown over his car. The Liberal Democrat candidate had the word bitch painted over her garage door by one of the, apparently one of the people who'd commented under Polly's tweet. And the police launched an investigation into where this harassment had come from, only to discover that it was personally the Conservative candidate.
It was the boring guy that done it.
The boring guy had done it. And he then had to stand by. That's how Richard Harrington, who became an excellent MP, actually entered Parliament. So, truthfully, you know, I can see you can select people. And I think, actually, you're right, Peter, and Ali was an example of that, who seem on the surface of it to be perfectly all right. And in any selection process, however robust, you can select poor people. But I would say this. In Wellingborough, the Conservative Party selected a candidate who, and if you look at the difference between the Wellingborough by-election and the Kingswood by-election, you can see how much bigger the Wellingborough swing was, whom voters on the doorstep, so I understand, said, you know, you've selected the partner of the disgraced former MP. What are you doing? And the Conservative Party did not, I think, exercise sufficiently strong control over who its local candidates are. So parties, I think, go in and out of that willingness to control, depending on how hungry they are for power. And at the moment, I think Labour is simply hungrier than the Tories, and is therefore being more robust about the candidates it's selected. And it has to be, because the moment it relaxes even for a second, it gets things like Rochdale wrong.
It's a much tighter operation altogether.
But there's two parts to this process, right? So the first is, what is the threshold for being an approved candidate at all? And then the question of, how do you actually select the candidate from that approved list? And the parties are in this tension between wanting to have kind of local democracy, local selections within their local selectorates, but wanting to exercise control. The first mechanism of control is that approvals standard that has been used. I used to sit on an approvals panel for the Liberal Democrats, testing whether the candidates knew enough about Liberal Democrat policy.
Testing whether they were boring enough.
No, yeah, exactly that, Peter. Did they know enough about Liberal Democrat policy? And you can kind of raise that threshold, but that means you end up... So there were the controversies, I think, when Nick Timothy was struck off the approved candidates list for some reason that I can't quite remember.
He didn't campaign when he was a special advisor.
Even though he was probably...
He was the guy who worked for Theresa May.
He was. But for me, actually, a big part of what's wrong with this process is the local selectorate problem. The kinds of people who join political parties are weirdos. I mean, they're just off. And particularly, you know, you then get sometimes very small groups of people, perhaps 100 people who are the ones willing to give their evening up to turn up at an in-person selection interview process. And those people's ability to think effectively about what the voters in their area might want or need is often significantly impaired by just the fact that they're weirdos. And so you end up, with, instead of trying to deal with that structurally, the parties just try and kind of raise the floor of what the quality of candidates are, or do sneaky stuff and get in and strike people off lists and intervene. Actually, I think David Cameron was onto something when he proposed doing something much, much more radical, which was having open selections so that it was all of the voters in any constituency who were allowed to vote for the Conservative Party candidate.
Whether they were members of the party
Party or not, much more like an American process. The idea is that that should reduce radicalisation. It doesn't necessarily work always to do that.
But they did it in Totnes in the run-up to 2010, where they had a particular expenses issue.
It was seen as working quite well, and they selected Sarah Wollaston, who was a former GP, wasn't really part of the party. But then as soon as she arrived in Westminster, she was basically a nightmare. Said she didn't want to toe the whip, and why was she being told to do this?
I don't think she was a nightmare.
Well, she was for the Tory party.
Yes, she was for the Tory party, but that's a very different point. Obviously, if you have a... The problem with the proposal is this. The executive rules through Parliament, and if you have a tremendous diversity of candidates and no party control, it's very difficult for the executive to govern under our system. That's the downside of it. The upside of it is you do actually get more independent-minded people who, in various cases... stretch the Conservative Party back towards, for example, the centre of its voters over the centre of its activists, which is a good thing, and it would be a good thing with Labour as well. So I do rather favour it, but I would acknowledge it has this problem, which is it then becomes quite difficult to whip, and if you can't whip, then it's very difficult to govern.
But what happens if you had this system and Conservative selections were inundated by organised armies of sort of UKIP, Reform UK, supporting people who just pour into the selection meeting, choose their favourite candidate, and they do this, in different parts of the country. And before you know where you are, complexion of the Conservative Party
is changed. Jeremy Corbyn as leader.
Or you get the Tory equivalent of Corbynism, which is sort of where we're heading in the Conservative Party.
I just want to play you something, Peter. I've just done this out because we're talking about, needing to do candidate selection and what happened in 97. I spoke to Margaret McDonough, who was the General Secretary, in the run-up to 1997, and she explained what happened when so many people got elected not expecting it.
We had candidates on the end of the phone saying, I didn't expect to get elected, or how am I going to tell my wife? Or, do you know what I mean? It was sort of, it changed, absolutely changed people's lives.
On the morning of the election, the day after polling day, I was dispatched from the Royal Festival Hall where we were celebrating this at 6 o'clock in the morning. Blair dispatched me back to Millbank in order to take a meeting to look at the people who had been elected.
Wow.
And there was a group of half a dozen officials, including the very famous Margaret McDonough. And we had to go through this list and try and identify who these people were, which way they leant, whether they are going to be sort of good, solid, loyal, Blair-supporting new Labourites. In the main, they were, actually, much to their and our surprise. It was a very serious question. Blair was quite concerned about it. 6 o'clock in the morning, we had that meeting.
Yeah, so it does at least look like Star was doing some of those checks now. We should just give you the list of all of the candidates in the Rochdale by-election. Azhar Ali is the Labour candidate, even though he's been disowned by the Labour Party. Mark Coleman is the independent. Simon Danchuk for Reform UK. Ian Donaldson for the Liberal Democrats. Paul Ellison for the Conservatives. George Galloway for the Workers' Party of Britain. Michael Howarth is an independent. William Howarth is an independent. Guy Otten for the Green Party. Raven Rodent Subortner for the official Monster Raving Loony Party. And David Tully is also an independent. So that's your full list of candidates in Rochdale. In a moment, we'll ask how to win in a recession, but this is how to win an election.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Yes, How to Win an Election with me, Matt Chorley, joined by our political masterminds, Peter Manson, Polly McKenzie and Daniel Finkelstein. So I wanted to ask, how can you win in a recession? The latest economic figures show that Britain fell into a recession in the second half of 2020. And lots of people kept saying it was a technical recession as opposed to a vibes-based recession.
A mere stagnation.
Yeah. Danny, we know there's a long list of things which you think don't matter. Does being in a recession in an election year matter?
Absolutely. It's the
primary thing. Yay, we found it.
Danny has identified something that will make a difference to help people vote.
So in a very, very good book called Why Message Matters by Lynn Vavreck, the political scientist, she essentially shows the strong relationship in US elections, this is, but I think the same occurs here, between economic performance in the last 6 to 9 months before an election and expected performance in the 3 to 6 months after the election. In terms of people's welfare, their disposable income, and that the relationship of that to voting. And then she asked the question, can you actually buck that? You know, if you're the candidate that is running for the opposition party and the economy is going very well, or you're the party that is running with the government and the economy is not going very well, are you doomed? And she argues, no, you're not completely doomed, but it's very difficult. That's the first point. But then she says, can you do anything about it? Yes, you can select an issue which you are able to campaign on, but your opposition, the other party, cannot. And you can try to elevate that into the issue for the election. And actually, interestingly, before the 2015 election, I remember that Ed Miliband, to be fair to him, as we say, had raised the issue of Lord Fink, a member of the House of Lords, and his tax affairs. And it was regarded as, you know, a successful hit on the Tories. And I wrote a column saying, I think he's going to lose the election. And the reason I thought that is because I thought that the economy was going to go against Labour, and I thought this demonstrated he didn't have a satisfactory alternative issue. And indeed, that, you know, whether or not my analysis was correct, obviously that did prove to be the case. So the issue for the big Conservative Party, because I think they're going to be the government in power and the economy is not going to be going strongly enough in their direction, is what is your alternative issue? And I see why they've then investigated the question of leaving the European Convention of Human Rights and going into a campaign on woke. I don't think that would work. I think it would split the Conservative Party and it wouldn't interest enough voters. But it is strategically a response to going into an election, even if not the correct response. But maybe Peter or Polly has an alternative.
I mean, it's perhaps what they're doing is trying to just dump the economy as an issue, as an election issue. I think it's extremely hard to do that for all the reasons that Danny has explained. But that's perhaps why they're turning to small boats, Rwanda, immigration. But the problem with them for immigration is that they are stoking up a great deal of sentiment and anger amongst Conservative supporters, as well as some others, but many, many Conservative supporters who, angry and disappointed at the government's performance over immigration, are now turning to Reform UK. So what we've seen over the last few months as they've banged the drum over immigration without providing solutions to it, is that support for Reform UK has grown. And that's what we saw in Wellingborough. And I think we'll see it in others. And the Reform UK, from a Conservative point of view, are in danger of taking off if Farage joins their campaign. If he hits the campaign trail between now and the election, he will put booster rockets under Reform UK, and then I think the Conservatives will indeed be well and truly sunk. So I don't think going on about immigration and boats and whatever is the answer to their problem.
But he's only got so many things he can keep talking about. Polly, I thought I'd look at the polling on this just to see how badly they're doing. Actually, in terms of how the public think the government's handling the economy, I mean, it's low, but the number of people saying they're handling it well is going up. The number of people saying it's handling it badly is coming down. And if you look at which government would be better at managing the economy, the Conservatives are on 20, under Rishi Sunak, are on 24%. Labour on 27, neither on 28. The Labour and the Conservatives are basically neck and neck on this. It's not like Labour are winning on the economy either, it doesn't feel like. But maybe that doesn't matter if you're not the government.
They're not massively ahead, but they are slightly ahead. And crucially, they're ahead on everything else. And if the Labour Party is ahead on the economy, the Labour Party sort of takes for granted that it's ahead on whether they do public services well. And they're also ahead on immigration by some measures. And again, partly because of the reason that Peter was just explaining, that the more the Conservatives talk up how tough they are on immigration whilst continuing to fail, the more they actually kind of push votes away from themselves and they push up the salience without dealing with their competence problem, and actually they get worse ratings on that. So there isn't another issue, as Danny suggests, that the Conservative Party can actually pick on that works for the centre. It's that, you know, it's like in chess, right? You're in check, and so you have to move. But the problem is that every move actually puts them into a worse situation because they're trying to move to the right to pick up the anti-woke vote to stop Reform taking them, but all they're doing is making the problem worse.
So I think the only thing that they can do is hope the economy comes right and tries to do what they can to engineer that it does at the right time. I think it's a very long shot because, you know, the basis of analysis is they're not going to win the election, but it's a very long shot. But you look at those figures and you can see Labour hasn't got an alternative issue, really. I mean, Tony Blair did have a kind of strong time for a change offering, and I don't think Keir Starmer quite does that. At the moment, he's dependent upon the fact that people are turning away from the Conservatives, and I think they are, and very strongly, and therefore, you know, I've never joined in this, you know, the problem with Keir Starmer thing, because it's ridiculous, given how well the party is doing in the polls. But if you were looking for a Conservative strategy, I think you would hope and try to engineer that the economy comes right, because you haven't got an alternative issue and you're probably not that far away on the economy. So therefore, insofar as there's a small glimmer, and we're looking here for strategies given the overall analysis, that's what I'd do.
If I was advising the Labour Party, I would accept that the economy is the baseline. You can't ignore it. You've got so much to demonstrate. Your credentials are so important. How you persuade people that you're going to be really disciplined and responsible when it comes to the public finances, and that you've really got a serious growth strategy that will enable us to turn a corner. But I would advise the Labour Party to campaign on two other issues. One would be the National Health Service and the other would be crime. I think in both these areas, the Conservatives have a poor record, one more obvious than the other, the health service. But I think on crime, we hear and see too little of what the Labour Party has to say about crime. And I think it's a much more important issue for voters than they appear currently to acknowledge.
Is that a Keir Starmer problem or a Yvette Cooper problem?
It's an opportunity, not a problem, Matt, for both of them. But it's something where Yvette Cooper, the Shadow Home Secretary, has got to take the lead. I mean, I think that on the economy, you've got in Rachel Reeves somebody who's basically established her credibility. She's got her credentials intact. Her, you know, moving on of the 28 billion was a signal development for her and showed, I think, her authority in this area. I think that how the Labour Party responds to the budget will be of some importance, but I don't think it's game-changing from the Conservative point of view. I think the problem for the Conservatives over the economy is that given the state of recession, stagnation, call it what you wish, and this is not going to be transformed, by the way, any time between now and the election, it makes it much harder for the Conservatives to defeat the argument that it's time for a change. And secondly, I think it makes tax cuts in the forthcoming budget problematic for them. I think, you know, when we're rewarding ourselves with tax cuts, when the economy is still in recession, looks weird. I think at the best, it's sort of, you know, premature. At worst, it's irresponsible. So I would be surprised that they get much politically out of a modest tax-cutting budget in March. But this places the onus on Labour, because what the Tories are going to say, well, if you think it's bad under us, oh my God, you know, wait until you see what will happen to the economy under this other lot. I mean, which brings us back to the almost the very first discussion we had on this podcast, which is at the end of the day, the Conservatives will campaign on better the devil you know. That's well, that is a cry of desperation on the part of the Conservatives. But the point is that it puts the onus on Labour to establish their credibility. They've got to be absolutely foursquare behind Rachel Reeves and the positions that she's taking so that we don't have a repeat of that other recession election, which was 1992, when suddenly and surprisingly for some, not for all of us, the Conservatives were able to snatch victory out of the jaws of defeat.
But in the run-up to that, when it was in the spring of 91, Norman Lamont talked about the green shoots and lots of people sort of criticised him for it, attacked him on the green shoots. I remember in the run-up to 2010, I was working for the West Morning News, coming to briefings with ministers, you were one of them, where we spent that whole sessions trying to get you to say the phrase green shoots. Can you see green shoots, Minister? Is there green shoots? Is there green shoots? And some of your colleagues were slightly better at avoiding that than others.
Well, I had one minister who didn't avoid it, and she still talks about it and is sort of licking her wounds even today. Wonderful, wonderful minister who's now really successful in the business world, and that's Shriti Vadera.
I think that was why we played the game.
The question is whether, if there are green shoots, whether we call them that or not, before the election, whether that actually helps the Conservatives enough. And, you know, what's interesting about 97 is actually the economy was by then doing really quite well. And yet, nevertheless, the Conservatives had lost their economic credibility because of the recession and Black Wednesday and the period that we'd kind of gone through in the mid-90s. And for me, it feels like because we have had such terrible kind of experiences in terms of people's living standards, which are worse than the kind of headline recession figures say, I think that even if there were green shoots, it would feel that the Conservatives' economic credibility is still so fundamentally wounded. And you'd still have what we had in 97, which is the combination of moribund public services and a kind of generalised sense of scandal and corruption. And when you've got all three of those together, loss of economic credibility, underfunded public service, it's absolutely terrible.
Yeah, it is. Look, the thing is that the Conservative Party obviously has to have a strategy. I think
they're really trying not to.
No, I think if you the reason for that is obvious, which is that when you alight on a strategy, you can immediately see what the flaws in it are. Yeah. So, for example, when Rishi Sunak decided he was going to go for this "We Are the Change" strategy, the reason for that was obvious, which is that if you don't represent change, you're going to be swept away by change. But on the other hand, the argument against doing it was it looked ridiculous, and so they had to abandon it. So what we're trying to investigate here is what would be the optimal strategy in the circumstances that all strategies are not likely to be good. My view is that with the economy, it's the peak and the end that matters. It's what the social psychologists call the peak-end rule. And the problem for the Conservatives is the peak experience was probably Liz Truss's premiership, where people felt the Conservative Party was to blame for, directly because of economic policies it pursued, whether or not, you know, somebody in the IEA could argue that it isn't, that's how people experienced it, was directly responsible for people's mortgages going up, and they felt that they were directly punished by the Conservative Party's policy. And so I think even if you get a mild uptick at the end, and you can reassure Shriti Vadera, it's not about whether they set I wasn't even aware that she'd said that. And
well, she didn't I'd forgotten entirely she did that
because that doesn't matter in the that you can bing again doesn't matter in the slightest. What matters is whether or not people experience that there's been a green shoot, not whether a politician does or doesn't say it. So you were wasting your time, Matt, is what I'm saying, trying to get them to say.
She did say, I am seeing a few green shoots, but it's a little too early to say exactly how they'd grow. Does sound like she did say that, Peter.
Very circumspect. Very circumspect. Look, what I don't want to see are echoes of Labour's 1992 campaign creeping into the campaign now. In 1992, you had a savaging of Neil Kinnock and his leadership by the Tory-supporting newspapers. You had a terrible sort of mess up by John Smith over tax and spending in his shadow budget. You then had in the sort of final 10 days of the campaign, the Labour Party suddenly went on a journey and decided that constitutional and electoral reform was suddenly an issue, which would motivate the voters to turn out to support Labour. And the voters were just left sort of confused by this. Mm. And then in the midst of all this, actually, the Labour Party campaign, I was actually in Hartlepool fighting it, I wasn't in London, but it just became rather bifurcated. I mean, it ended up with nobody really in charge. You had sort of a dual-track campaign being sort of spearheaded by different people, and the result was confusion. If you want to win, you have to have absolute strategic purpose, clarity and discipline. Otherwise, you're lost.
Very good. We managed to get through all that. Nobody's mentioned Citizens Assemblies, which is a tribe. Right, we'll do some of your...
Citizens Assemblies, I mean, I'm sure they've got a lot to be said for Citizens Assembly, but is that really the voters' priority?
Well, according to Sue Gray, it is.
Election year or the Labour announcement that we're suddenly going to reopen the issue of fox hunting, not to scrap the ban, but to tighten it up and to relitigate the whole issue. I mean, these are third or fourth order issues for the public. They've got to remain focused on their strategy and on the key issues which are important to voters.
Right, enough questions from me. Let's have a question from a listener. This is Tim, who says he's a Brexit refugee living in Italy.
I was in Millbank Tower in the last week of the 1997 campaign when Peter Mandelson gathered all the staff and said, if we win on Thursday, it will in part be due to the foundations laid by this man. He then introduced Neil Kinnock to speak. For the many seasoned campaigners present, it was an extremely moving moment. What have been the presenter's most emotional experiences in an election campaign?
Good question from Tim. I suppose, as it was mentioned to you, Peter, what's been your most emotional experience in a campaign?
Well, just one point about Neil Kinnock. If Neil Kinnock hadn't saved the Labour Party in the 1980s, there'd have been nothing there for Tony Blair to modernise in the 1990s. That is the hero. That is the heroism of Neil Kinnock. Now, obviously, the most emotional time for me was when, against the odds, when everyone told me I had to stand down and not fight again in Hartlepool and said the voters would rebel and they wouldn't back me, and all the press descended and sort of scoured my town for people to say nasty things about me. On election night, I sort of smashed it. And that was a very, very emotional time. When I say
this is the fight and not a quitter.
When I say I smashed it, I mean I did speak. I became a little shouty about it. But the reason I became shouty was because Arthur Scargill and his supporters, Arthur, who had stood against me in this election, you know, to give people the chance of Hartlepool to vote for real socialism as opposed to my version of it, they were sort of barracking me in the front. And so I sort of didn't realise that, of course, nobody could pick up what they were saying and doing. So I sort of started shouting into the microphone. But anyway, I was very emotional. Yeah. And it was a huge relief, and I'm glad to say that no sooner had the result been announced than Tony Blair and Alistair Campbell phoned me from their car and said, well done, it's a tremendous result, we knew you were going to smash it. And I said, well, thank you very much, Tony, thank you, Alistair. But it was nice of them to take the trouble.
Polly, when do you get emotional?
Oh, I cry all the time, but... it's always the results, I think, because that's the crystallisation of all of this tension and hard work and exhaustion, and then suddenly you know whether it worked or it didn't work. I mean, after 2015, obviously the Liberal Democrats had lost almost all of our seats. And a large number of staff went to the headquarters and Paddy Ashdown stood on a table and he said, why would anybody do what's right in the national interest again in politics? And that was quite heartbreaking. We then sort of traipsed up to the MAL, I think, the ICA, Institute for Competition, somewhere like that, where Nick Clegg gave his resignation speech. And having seen Ed Miliband's sort of, oh, oops, I lost speech, I think the contrast between the two of them was extraordinary. Ed Miliband just sort of made a joke about Milifans and hadn't it all been a laugh? The real fun is the friends we made along the way kind of stuff. And for Nick, it was absolutely devastating.
Yeah, the election night when I ran in Harrow West and didn't win, just being able to thank the people who'd campaigned for me and actually congratulate the people who'd campaigned for Labour, because I felt winning a seat in Parliament, which Gareth Thomas had done, you know, is an amazing thing. So that was emotional, because I think it's a sort of celebration of democracy, election night. And, you know, I felt that was emotional.
Lovely. Not a nice note to end on, rather than talking about citizens' assemblies. Lovely to see you all. Peter Madison, Polly McKenzie, Daniel Finkelstein. Who's going to go viral this week? We just don't know. You can obviously follow us on at Times Radio.
Don't we have to say something really extreme to go viral?
Yeah.
Okay, is between now and next week.
Yeah, could try and come up with something. Don't forget to subscribe on that. You can email us howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. If you send your questions, we'll be back same time next week.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode, too.
We're professional unprofessionals, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.